Good morning. Thanks for having me back. Those of you who may not know me, I should start with a confession that one of the things I do and love is being a church history lecturer. So that tends to mean that some of the topics I get asked to speak on have a bit of an historical aspect to them. So sometimes it sounds a bit more like a lecture perhaps than a sermon. So you might be listening to a bit of a lecton or something today. But I need to thank Ken for not pinching one of my dad jokes that I shared with him when we were talking about the service on the phone during the week. And talking about fundamentalism. And I think I said something like, you know, this is a topic you can have a fair bit of fun with because it is occasionally a bit mental. So, there you go.
Can we have it up, please? The volume?
Volume up, okay. I'm not quite sure how to turn the volume up. Done. Excellent. I can speak louder, but that would probably discomfort the rest of you. Okay, so we're going to talk about these terms, fundamentalism, fundamentalist, the ways in which they're used, the way in which they've come about. Today, if someone calls you a fundamentalist, it's probably an insult. If you call yourself a fundamentalist, you're probably taking it on as a bit of a badge of honour, I guess. But being wired as an historian, we usually like going back to the beginning and tracing things through chronologically, a bit predictable, a bit boring like that. So we'll do a little bit of that. When we look at the history of this particular term, it's not really, as a term, something that has a long history. It really only begins in the beginning of the 20th century with a couple of brothers whose names were Milton and Lyman Stewart. Now, they were wealthy, and we're looking at the year around 1910. And as Christians, they were concerned by some of the developments that they saw in the world around them, things that they saw as threats to biblical Orthodox Christianity. So they decided to take a stand. They felt something needed to be done. And they issued a series of pamphlets that were called The Fundamentals, A Testimony of Truth. And they printed literally millions of these and distributed them particularly across the United States, free of charge. Now, when you look at what they were trying to do with that particular series of pamphlets, they were trying to defend, perhaps explain, some of the doctrines that they felt were coming under attack. Examples. I should be getting ahead of myself here. Keeping up. Okay. So one of those doctrines they felt was particularly under threat was this one, the inerrancy of the Bible. Now, we don't have time to go into all of these in detail today, so I'll flick them up fairly quickly. The direct creation of the world by God and humanity. Miracles, the authenticity of miracles. Well, later, in a few minutes, we'll talk a little bit about why some of these were particularly under attack, which I'm sure many of you already know. Virgin birth of Jesus. His crucifixion, the resurrection, and the idea of substitutionary atonement. And also the idea that there was going to be a second coming. Now, as I'm sure most of you will know, none of these dot points there were particularly new. They'd all had some degree of traction, some of them a very long history within Christian teaching. So why the need to suddenly go into bat for them? So the answers to that really lie in a lot of the circumstances of the 19th century. But we need to jump back just a bit further, really, to give it a bit of a deeper context. So for those of you who had inflicted on you the four-part series I did here on church history, if you remember about some of the key points there, one of the key points was as the church was transitioning from the medieval period into the modern period, we encounter something called the Enlightenment. This is a movement that puts reason, rationalism to the fore. And that, in a sense, also draws on an earlier context of the Reformation and the Renaissance. So we have universities, we have the printing press, we have a rise in literacy. All of that contributes to a more educated public who, around about 1700 with the Enlightenment, start to do some interesting things. And one of the broad things that starts to happen is there's an increasing tendency to question authority of all kinds. So when we looked, say, at the Reformation, obviously people like Martin Luther and others were questioning the authority of the Roman Catholic Church. Because the Roman Catholic Church had been so allied with state, that led only, say, 100 years or so later, to serious questioning about the role and the rights of monarchs. And so it moved from questioning the authority of the church to questioning the authority of the state. And then by the time we get to the, say, the late 1600s, 1700s, it's moved to, say, questioning the authority of scripture. So there's this, if not anti-authoritarian, at least a questioning of authority, a movement of that starts some centuries ago and keeps going through. And increasingly, the idea of reason being the measure of all things was in view. So when we hit the 19th century, just before fundamentalism hits, we see a number of ideas that probably ideas you've all heard of that really historically are coming at around about the same time. If you get a number of very key ideas coming within 100 years, that's pretty significant. One of the first of these is Marxism. So the idea coming out with Karl Marx in the middle of the 19th century that really, okay, what's these are all things that are, I guess, challenge people's idea of reality. What is happening around us and why is it happening around us? So Marx came out with an idea that said, well, you can't really understand humanity and human society and what's going on politically and socially unless you understand economics. Economics is the driving force, and inequalities in economics are the driving force. And that was a view that was increasingly linked with atheism and represented something of a challenge to the church. We also have Darwinism. So the idea essentially developing that really chance is the real creator. Alternative view to the fact, obviously, that God is creator. Everything, how do we explain things around us? Well, it's chance, it's natural selection, it's survival of the fittest, combination of those sorts of things. There were some unfortunate outworkings of this in terms of politics and social theory, etc., as well. So-called higher criticism. We've already mentioned briefly that the idea of the authority of the Bible had been examined for some time. But now there were, in the 19th century, some very, rather than people say just saying, oh, I just ignore the Bible or I dismiss the Bible, there were people who were taking the Bible very seriously and yet laying out fundamentally different ways in which it could be understood from what had been in the past. So all of these layers are coming to bear in the 19th century. Freud, particularly a bit later on, what's religion? Well, you know, the famous saying, was it the opiate of the masses? You know, religion is simply a way that weak people deal with life's sufferings and inconsiderations. So all of these things were combining. In addition, less of an idea, but more of an event, really, the 19th century was a huge era for expansion of colonialism, as we know. So that one of the side effects of that was it meant that the colonising powers came in contact a lot more with other religions, other philosophies, different ways of looking at things that in some way subtly challenged the primacy of the Christian view that they'd held for so long. That led a lot of people to wondering, well, something you've probably heard, perhaps all religions are really the same. Yeah. Perhaps they're really just, there's just one truth and they're all, you know, the different paths up the mountain idea. So this led to really a lot of insecurity cumulatively in Orthodox Christianity. And it was largely that sort of snowball rolling down the hill, in a sense, that the Stuarts felt was about to wipe out the village, as it were, and that they were writing or sponsoring the fundamentals into that particular context. One of the things you've probably heard of, in the 1920s, there was the Scopes trial. So this was the trial whereby somebody, because it was illegal to actually teach evolution in schools, there was a trial around this particular issue. The person who had taught evolution in schools was found guilty. It was overturned on appeal. The upshot of that, the interest of that for our point of view, is that it led to the idea that that people who stood for these things that were written about, these doctrines that were written about in the fundamentals, were, if you like, rednecks, hillbillies, anti-modern ideas. There's some truth in some of that, as we'll see. In this same period, from the term fundamentals, or we have the development of the terms fundamentalism and fundamentalist. It took about 10 years for them to be developed, about 10 years before we see the term fundamentalist after the publication of the Fundamentals. There was an American writer, not at all sympathetic to fundamentalism, a guy called H.L. Mencken, who joked that if you drove anywhere in America in the 1920s and threw a rock out of the window of your car, you'd hit a fundamentalist. So evidently the idea was that even though the term had only come into use in about 1910, by 10 or 15 years or so later, apparently there were recognisably quite a lot of these, the fundamentalists around in America. So what had become initially a term with no real negative connotations, fundamentals, fundamentalist, quickly developed into something that could be identified as outside of the mainstream and perhaps not just conservative, but perhaps retrogressive as well. This last dot point there is just something I put together. It's really one way of looking at fundamentalism is that it develops through the 20th century to be something of an opposition movement to the forces of modernism, particularly something that's coming up in Protestant Christianity. In the meantime, which is not really our topic, but the Roman Catholic Church was having its own way of opposing the forces of modernism in things like Vatican I, and it was in its own way being quite fundamentalist, because it was pushing the forces of modernism away. Also, after the Scopes trial, when fundamentalists realised how they were being seen, one of the easiest things to do was just to deal with this by avoiding and separating from groups that saw them that way or didn't agree with them. And one of the interesting things that came out of that was increasingly fundamentalists saw education as the enemy. The people on the previous slide, for example, when we looked at higher education, but also the other things that were dot points there, the fundamentalists realised, well, hang on, the people who are doing this higher criticism stuff, they've all been to university. And a lot of these Marxists and these Darwinians, they've been to university. So what do? We don't go to university. Those of us who've studied at Vos and elsewhere, will have probably heard someone say something like, the solution to, you sometimes hear people say, when you use the word theology, theology or doctrine, that the solution to bad theology isn't no theology, but good theology. So engagement is one of the things that is, I think most of us would agree, is helpful. But this is not the way that the fundamentalist movement went. And something I've heard, I'll ask for a show of hands, who's ever heard anyone say this from a pulpit? God said it, I believe it, and that settles it. Anyone ever heard that? Okay, fantastic. sounds great for a while until you think about it. Okay? It's almost a fundamentalist credo, I think. And the thing that is so incredibly dangerous about that is what it doesn't say. There should at least be three more words in there. After I believe it, it should be something like I interpret it. And that step that's missing out there is hugely important. So if I hear anyone say that these days, I run a mile in the opposite direction, because I think it's one of the most, they're probably a lovely person, you know, but it's one of the most dangerous things you can really hear somebody say. Run away, if you hear that. Okay, so one of the things, one of the questions that surfaces then around about here is, well, what's really the difference between fundamentalists and evangelicals? Because the list of dot points we put up on the earlier slide that indicates what the Stuarts were trying to defend with their pamphlets, the fundamentals, well, a lot of those things are believed by evangelicals anyway. So I'll acknowledge where I've got this particular source from. You mightn't be able to read it, but it's from an author called Harris, not Brian Harris. Fundamentalism and Evangelicals, published a few years ago. There's another slide to come finishing off this table. So if you can't actually read that, okay, so fundamentalists are suspicious of scholarship and science. Now this, I have to say at the first, this list was compiled by an evangelical. Okay, so disclaimer up front. Quite possibly, this list might look slightly different if compiled by a fundamentalist. Anyway, this, let's have a look at these quickly. This side, suspicious of scholarship and science. This side, encourage academic study in order to develop a deeper understanding of faith. This side, tend to be anti-intellectual. I think I might have missed one out there. Oh no, that lines up with the first one, yep. Have a mechanical view of how the Bible is written. Believe it's essential to understand the culture and circumstances in which the Bible is written. Tend to believe that if the King James is good enough for the Apostle Paul, it's good enough for me. Whereas over here, while we value the authorised version, we are perhaps aware of some of the issues behind passing on manuscripts and translation of manuscripts, and for those reasons prefer to use a more recent one. Have a quite literalistic approach to interpreting the Bible, except certain passages that might refer to biblical instructions about instructing parapet walls and things, which they probably don't follow through literally with their current council. But anyway. Whereas the evangelicals tend to acknowledge that, look, there's lots of things going on in the Bible. Some of it's poetry, prophecy, metaphor, symbol, and it should therefore be understood accordingly. Okay, the separation thing, rejecting involvement with Christians who don't accept their views. Over here, well, okay, look, we've got things that we're not prepared to back down on. We believe there's essentials, but we believe there's a wide penumbra, if you like, around that, that we're actually not prepared to kill people over. You know, often allowing culture to influence their beliefs without realising that it is. I mean, we all allow culture to influence our beliefs, but over here, there's a bit more of an awareness of the fact that that happens and a preparedness to allow the Bible and other thought to challenge even our own cultural understandings. There was an interesting, this one's an interesting one, because there was a reaction to the liberal theology, so-called, of the 19th, 20th centuries that was seen as overly investing in social activities to compensate for a vacuum of doctrine. Okay, and therefore people who felt that they did not have a vacuum of doctrine felt that the indulgence in trying to do good in society was something that was at best an optional extra for the church, and at worst really a betrayal of what our core job is, which is preaching and teaching the truth. And often very determined on certain understandings of the second coming, whereas, you know, a bit less, a bit more what is it, pan-millennial. You know, it's all going to pan out in the end. That's fine. I don't have to sweat too much about that one. So that's a list to think about that particular difference, perhaps spotting where you might be on that particular list. Just with the whole education idea, I don't think I've mentioned here before, but you know, when I was going to study for 3 years in the mid-90s at what's now Vos, and said to somebody, you know, I'm going to, I probably did say this actually, so excuse me for repeating it, might have done it in one of the history sessions, but when I told someone I was going to do that, and said I'm going to study at theological college, and she, there was this intake of breath that sucked most of the oxygen out of the room at the time, and she said, don't lose your faith. And I don't think it was the word Baptist in front of theological college that was the problem. I think it was the word theology in the middle there. The idea that coming out of that fundamentalist view that if you're going to pursue education, education is the enemy of faith. So pursuing education is implicitly putting your faith at risk. Okay. We'll jump back for a moment to the 20th century. The battle lines were drawn really after the Scopes trial with the fundamentalists, and the idea that their idea of the second coming, most of them tended to be what's called premillennialists. In other words, they expected things to get worse and worse and worse, and then Jesus to come back. So the fact that they were getting a lot of opposition in society was easily interpreted through that particular filter. The more people disagree with us, that's fine. It just means we're closer to Jesus' return. So it became really self-fulfilling. Meant the closer that Jesus was, so that was good. So their rejection by a lot of the secular world and other Christian groups didn't exactly have them licking their wounds, did have them retreating to their own little enclaves. They did have their own colleges, you know, but they would insist on the education being done by people who worked and operated within their particular worldview. Okay. When we look at this particular list, most of the things on those two slides, they're not essentially doctrinal issues, are they? When you analyse those, a lot of them tend to be attitudinal things. And you know, one of the very funny quotes, I think from Jerry Falwell, when someone said to him, well, what is a fundamentalist? And he said, well, a fundamentalist is just an evangelical who's angry about something. And the anger is something that is worth pondering. Now, we're used, so far in what I've said, I've only talked about Christian fundamentalism. We're obviously used to the term fundamentalist being used in an Islamic context, but there are all types of fundamentalism. You know, I shared last time I was here that I had a background in an offshoot of Mormonism. There are certainly Mormon fundamentalists. There are Jewish fundamentalists. There's goodness knows how many types of fundamentalists. There are many of them. So therefore, it makes the idea of taxonomy or classification of these groups really interesting, because doctrinally, ultimately, they don't have anything in common at all when you put them all on a table together. So therefore, it's not content so much that is perhaps a distinguishing hallmark of fundamentalists, but perhaps attitude that is the distinguishing hallmarks. So if we take that broad view then and say, well, what do all fundamentalists, regardless of their doctrinal content, what sort of things do they seem to have in common? Okay, firstly, yes, a very, very clear idea of what they believe in almost all areas. So the idea that somebody might ask you a question like, well, what usual colour robe did Jesus wear? The fact you mightn't have an answer to that question would be seen as quite threatening. because you're supposed to have answers. Incidentally, having looked at Mormonism and the beginnings of that, as I've had to, I think that sometimes people have asked me to talk on cults and things like that. When people say, how does a cult start? One of the key ingredients is the belief that you have to have the answers to everything. And if someone comes along saying, I believe I've got the answers to everything, or I've got more of them than you do, that's a key ingredient in the recipe of how to create a cult. Okay. An allergic reaction to doubt, even when it's completely honest doubt. Doubt is usually seen as the opposite of faith. So if you've got a doubt, there's a problem. Okay. Now I've certainly been, you know, I've been part of groups where this has been an issue. So doubt is seen as the enemy of faith, not in fact the path to faith, which I think it probably more often is. As implied in the whole avoidance separation points earlier, fundamentalist groups, I believe, tend to reject open dialogue with groups who don't support all of the points that they, even if they've got substantial agreement with them. Now, you know, one of the interesting issues here historically was around Billy Graham, who came essentially out of a fundamentalist background, and one of the issues he faced in the earlier part of the 20th century was, should he, with that background, have anything to do with evangelicals? And yet, as we've seen, there's a significant overlap of doctrinal agreement between fundamentalists and evangelicals, and it was a key decision in Billy Graham's ministry that he decided to go down that path of engaging with evangelicals. A lot of people were saying to him at the time that was the wrong thing to do. Refusal to compromise, a tendency to be afraid and threatened by other views, and finally, the idea that this can even lead to physical violence. So if you are so convinced that you're in the right and everyone else is in the wrong, then obviously you need to act in a way that is consistent with what you believe. And if you don't act in a way that is consistent with what you believe, then you lack integrity. So you have to act in a way consistent with what you believe, and if you believe that what other people teach that is different from what you believe is a major problem, then what happens if you just let that continue to exist or flourish? That is, and then you start getting back into an idea that I think is quite medieval, which is the idea of feeling you have to defend God's honour in some way. So, taking that word medieval, one of the things, as I've reflected over fundamentalism for a while now, I think in many ways it is a rechanneling of a medieval impulse. Those of you who were here when we looked at the transition of the church from the medieval to the modern age, you might recall we talked about things like the Treaty of Westphalia, the idea that people finally were forced to the point where they had to acknowledge they had to live in the same area as people whose religious convictions were different from their own. So one of the hallmarks of modernity has been, even if we don't necessarily like it, what other people believe, that we accept that we need to live in proximity to people whose views are profoundly different from our own, and we need to do it without killing each other. That was one of the hallmarks that meant the West moved from the Middle Ages to what we call the modern era. Okay. Sometimes fundamentalists, I think, are still trapped in medievalism. And one of the ironies, I think one of the great ironies here, is that fundamentalists are very different from a lot of other groups like secular humanists, and certainly different theologically from liberal theologians, but in many ways they're using the same tools, the tools of rationalism. Now, I'm not, don't have time to go into all this in detail, I'm not remotely saying we should ditch the Enlightenment, ditch the tools of reason, but I am saying that there have been a lot of things happened in the last couple of hundred years that indicate that that particular toolkit is not in and of itself sufficient. So the one of the ironies is that fundamentalists are using this same sort of rational toolkit that people who end up in very different places theologically are also using. This leads them to have the same confidence, and often arrogant confidence, that they can actually accurately discern where meaning lies. And I think it's ultimately a little bit naive and overly optimistic, which is a characteristic of modernity anyway, and one of the things that post-modernity is challenging in various ways. Romanticism, which is a favourite topic of mine and we can't go into, addresses in various ways some of the shortfallings in the toolkit that rationalism provides. I was interested to hear, I think it was Tim mentioning to someone earlier about, used the term bibliolatry, which was a term that obviously some of you are familiar with, the idea that you're making an idol of the Bible, etc. That term was in fact invented by one of the great romantics, Samuel Taylor Coleridge. That term came into existence by his hand. And it was addressing the what he saw as the shortcomings in the view that everything could be completely contained and understood. Coleridge, most romantics, and a lot of postmoderns are increasingly comfortable with the idea that there's mystery out there. That whereas for people who are hardcore rationalists, a mystery is almost a personal affront. If we don't know the answer to something, we're jolly well going to. And we're going to pour our resources in it until we get the answer. Well, God doesn't fit neatly into that. Mystery, fear, the unknown, things like that were embraced by Romanticism, but rationalism didn't really do that. So the big irony is that by following that particular pathway, fundamentalists actually are pushing the God of mystery, the God who's bigger than, away. At the same time, they actually believe they're doing their best to defend God and truth. Funny word there, Procrustean. Anyone heard of Procrustes? He's a figure out of Greek mythology, and he was a pretty obscure one. He was a guy who used to live in the mountains, and he had a house, and travellers would often come by. And they would need to stay the night, so they would stay in his guest room. And Procrustes had a bed that was a certain size. And so what would happen would be that, it gets a bit gory here, I'm afraid, that Procrustes insisted that any of his guests staying in his bed had to fit the bed. So if you were too short, you got stretched. And if you were too long, those bits got lopped off. Okay. And I find a bit of a similarity there, because I think ultimately, you know, whether it's, you know, we're particularly talking in the Christian context here, but I think this is something in common with most fundamentalists, is that they have a rigid idea of who God is, and he's jolly well got to fit it. And this, in its own way, you know, if you're insisting God's got to fit that particular idea, it's really self-deification when you come down to it. And I think that's one of the... Most fundamentalists would be shocked to think that, but I think that's the pathway. And funnily enough, I think it's also the pathway that a lot of secular rationalists also are travelling, even though on the outside the groups look very, very different indeed. Okay, closing, last slide. Okay, for us, history lesson. We've done a bit of a history lesson. Although we've made the point that fundamentalism as a term only started in the early 20th century, fundamentalists really have always been around. The Pharisees, for example. You can go back through really any particular period in history that you want and see if you take fundamentalism as being an attitude to rather than a doctrinal content, you'll start to see it springing up everywhere, even if not by that particular name. So I think one of the things that this calls us to do is to recognise Are there any ways in which we exhibit a fundamentalist trait? We'll certainly know people who do, even if it's not me, of course. It's not me. But I know someone who's got this problem. Then perhaps what we've shared this morning will help give a bit of a deeper context and an understanding to where they're coming from. I don't want to what I've said to be interpreted as a way of saying, well, we can't be confident in our beliefs. We can't know what we believe. But I think we have to hold that with the humility of realising that we are interpreting it. And you know, I think that calls us back to the Christian community to share and to be humble to have other people input into our ideas. And perhaps at a broader level to be comfortable with this idea of mystery, to see mystery and to see doubt as not something that are threats to our faith, not something as puzzles that we have to solve, but in fact can be areas that are a crucible of our faith, because you know, I believe we serve a God who will remain mysterious to us by definition, and for me to insist that God becomes someone that I can completely comprehend is a fundamental error. So hopefully this is something we can take away with us. Thank you. Peter.
I really find that interesting. You say that fundamentalism exists across religions, and that the actual characteristics of the fundamentalists within those religions are very similar. But the same is true of mystics. So, is it possible that we could actually say that fundamentalism is a personality type?
Well, we could always get Women's Day to, you know, draw up one of those personality quizzes. And look, I think from, I guess, my reading, I think it's something that is, it's a culture. That's my feeling. You know, if you're brought up in a fundamentalist family, you're likely to be fundamentalist. Yes? Sure.
Fundamental nutritionism. Mm-hmm. And we've looked at it, and one of the explanations I find very helpful is that it's based on what they call dichotomous thinking, which is black and white thinking. Mm-hmm. And that's a type of thinking that children do. And as we mature and get older, we learn, they should call it choice. In other words, we form dimensions.
Sure.
So in actual But just thinking
of
people talking about religion,
it
comes up with other areas as well.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm fascinated by the distinction you made between fundamentalism and evangelicalism, because mm-hmm. you know, I love many Christian friends dearly, many of whom call themselves evangelicals. Yeah, yeah. But what you've just symptoms you described, they're fundamentalists. I'm not sure I've ever met an evangelical.
Okay.
But at least, but, I mean, of course I have to. But based on your definition, that right, a lot of the people in my church and in life, I would call them evangelicals based on your, whereas I'm eschewing that word these days because of the negative connotations.
Sure.
So what it feels like is that attitude that you describe seems to pervade just such a huge part of Christianity, not just the extreme fringe.
Yeah. And as a result, one of the things that's been interesting to see over the last few decades is that those who are comfortable with the label of evangelical have been increasingly keen to distance themselves from fundamentalism. Whereas for large parts of the non-Christian world, fundamentalism is a very broad term that would encompass all evangelicalism. Because they seem to be more aware of the term fundamentalist than evangelical.